Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good Monday morning. Thanks for listening to the show here on 91.5 KJZZ in Phoenix with Lauren Gilger. I'm Steve Goldstein. It is a summer edition of the show as we're focused on local and regional coverage with a one-hour program starting every weekday morning at 9. Coming up this hour, Governor Ducey signed a number of bills but issued one surprising veto, and wildlife hunting contests may be a thing of the past in Arizona.
Many businesses in Mexico and along the border were dreading today. It was the day tariffs on all Mexican imports threatened by President Donald Trump were set to begin. A last-minute deal reached between the two countries has stopped those tariffs for now. And now to get the latest on the deal and reactions to it, we've got Murphy Woodhouse on the line from KJZZ's Fronteras Desk in Hermosillo, Mexico. Good morning, Murphy.
Good morning, Lauren.
Okay, so before we get into the deal that was reached on Friday, there was another tweet this morning, right?
There's always another tweet.
Right.
So early this morning, Donald Trump did not provide many details, but he alluded to what he said was a very important part of the immigration security deal. One, quote, the U.S. has been asking about getting for many years. It will be revealed in the not too distant future. And if he says that the Mexican legislature will have to take action on that, and if whatever that deal is does not move forward, he again, of course, threatens tariffs.
Okay, so we don't know exactly what that means, but what were some of the key elements of the deal that leaders did release and reach on Friday?
For sure, yeah. One of the big ones was an expansion of what is known as the migrant protection protocols border-wide. That's an already existing program, but currently pretty small scale, in which Central American asylum applicants in the U.S. are returned quickly to Mexico to wait for their cases to proceed. Beyond that, Mexico has promised to deploy their recently created National Guard across the country with a special focus on southern Mexico and the border with Chiapas, where many of the Central Americans cross into Mexico. And then also there are elements of support for regional development in southern Mexico and Central America, with the idea being that a more stable and prosperous Central America would not be sending as many migrants.
So it sounds like there's a little bit for everybody in this.
There are a lot of elements, yes.
Yeah. So what are reactions like to this? I know we've heard some positive reactions from the business community on this side of the border.
For certain. And relief, I would say, has been the most significant reaction to this deal, certainly among the border and Mexican business leaders I've spoken with. Those tariffs would have been a major barrier. I mean, they started at 5%. You hear 5% all the time, but would have increased stepwise to 25% by October, which would have represented significant costs on imports and ultimately to the consumers, the U.S. consumers of many of those goods.
Mm-hmm.
And then some more critical responses that have come through as people have kind of digested the deal. Some people have pointed to the fact that many of these elements may have already previously been agreed to. There's the sort of line is there's not much new here. And then also the MPP, the Migration Protection Protocols, those could represent a major burden for Mexico. They were sort of presented as an alternative to Mexico becoming a safe third country in which those Central Americans would actually seek asylum in Mexico. But because asylum cases take so long and because Mexico has promised to provide many services to those awaiting the conclusion of their cases, you could still have Central Americans waiting for years in Mexico across the country, and especially in northern cities.
All right. So even though tariffs have not been imposed, I can't imagine there were not, you know, already impacts just from the threat of a tariff, right?
Yeah. So this tariff threat comes on the heels of a number of threats to shut down the border. So there have been a lot of threats that have scared a lot of border businesses in recent months. Businesses don't like uncertainty, and there's been a great deal of uncertainty recently. And just to cite sort of one specific example of how these things can have consequences, even though the policies may never become real, mm-hmm. A lot of Mexican planters are currently putting their planting schedules together, what they're going to grow, how much they're going to grow, et cetera. And they're doing that in an environment in which you know, they were facing 5% tariffs, possibly up to 25% tariffs. Now they're not. So there's just, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty, and that itself can have a great number of impacts.
Yeah, definitely. All right. That is Murphy Woodhouse from our Fronteras desk in Hermosillo, Mexico, talking about the latest deal reached on tariffs with Mexico. Murphy, thank you so much for joining us.
I always have a good time. Thanks a lot.
So President Trump says the 5% tariffs won't be slapped on goods from Mexico today, but that doesn't mean he won't reintroduce that threat sometime in the near future. If he does, where does that leave American businesses, and how could it affect Arizona's relationship with Mexico? I caught up with economist Jim Rounds of Rounds Consulting to ask him about how much that uncertainty impacts how business leaders decide what to do.
Yeah, and it's that uncertainty issue that comes up a lot. We've already had uncertainty for the last year related to talks with China. We've had a difficult time implementing, you know, the equivalent of NAFTA 2.0 by different name, but people understand that terminology better. This ratcheted it up quite a bit because the country directly south of us, where we have spent a lot of time building a solid relationship and where we could be seeing exponential economic opportunities going forward, talking 25% tariffs on all goods. That's very severe. And when you see the uncertainty, that's when you see job numbers suddenly come in a little bit lower than you would expect. You see the stock market start to slip a little bit eventually. But the U.S. economy is still very strong. Don't put too much into the recent job numbers just yet. Look for another couple of months of weakness. But the Arizona economy is outperforming the rest of the nation. And as long as this isn't long lasting, we're still going to be a leader over the next entire decade. Mm-hmm. But that's my concern. My bigger concern is longer term, but it's still not good short term.
You've built this great relationship with Mexico. The economy's still doing well. Why shoot yourself in the foot other than in a negotiating tactic? Is there anyone that you trust in the realm of business or the economy that feels like tariffs in this case would make sense?
People that understand math know that the tariffs don't make sense. The people that purposely ignore it have a different opinion. On these types of issues, though, it is an economic issue. But in terms of the negotiations and what I'm used to is I could come in and provide numbers and estimates and say, here's what could happen. That might be 25% of the conversation. The other 75% or even more could be more political discussions. And so logic, when you can't just say here's the right number and it's not just a 2 + 2 = 4, it's a little bit more complex. These discussions drag out, and we have very strong personalities in certain political positions across the country that are feverish about immigration issues. And I think that's fine, but there's a little bit of a disconnect between the tariff of 25% potentially hurting our economy and what's happening across the border, but maybe it is getting some people's attention.
What about tourism? Is this gonna hurt the relationship enough where fewer folks from Mexico will want to come to America, at least for a short period?
That's a really good question. You have the tax, essentially, that's passed along to the consumer in all these different ways. You have the longer-term impact of business development and the tourist side, too. And there are many studies. U of A puts out fantastic studies every year or two. And the numbers are significant. And I think some of the tensions will cause some short-term problems. But longer-term, that would be another thing to add to the bigger economic consequences. Slower job growth, but part of that would be the tourism industry. So this thing really reaches almost everything. It seems like a simple international trade tariff. Mm-hmm. This is a three-minute story. No, this touches the entire economy.
So you're an economist, but you know politics well. What does it say to you, if anything, at this point? The U.S. Chamber has come out strongly against this. Obviously, the Arizona Chamber, Glenn Hammer, has as well. It almost seems like it's falling on deaf ears. Does that tell you something about the politics of the economy and tariffs and even how this administration feels about those?
I think it seems like it's falling on deaf ears, but it's really not. And the Arizona Chamber and Glenn Hammer, when I need to better understand a complicated international trade issue, I call them. When you're negotiating, you're helping communicate, you have all these new relationships that can maybe, you might be helping to work things out behind the scenes. I think that they understand the economic impact, but they also are responsible for some of our economic growth, or a big chunk of our economic growth and strength, because of everything they've been doing. So they know the value of our relationship with Mexico and international trade. The people that I know in the administration and in the different places down at the state capitol, they know these things. It's just, you have to be careful when you negotiate, and you can't, you have to play things close to the vest for a little while.
Economist Jim Rounds is president of Rounds Consulting. Jim, good to see you as always. Thanks.
Thank you.
Easier evictions for landlords and reduced fees for certified medical marijuana cardholders are two of the bills Governor Doug Ducey signed into law recently, but four bills were vetoed by the governor, including one that would have given lawmakers a boost in pay via a per diem increase. Here with more details on all of this is Howard Fisher with Capital Media Services. Good morning, Howie.
Good morning. The governor has to always let everyone know he's in charge, which is why for the whole session, we actually got 11 bills the governor vetoed.
Wow. 11 is a good number there. But let's start with this per diem increase. So this was sort of snuck through at the last minute by lawmakers, too, right?
Well, they say it wasn't snuck through. The fact is it did go through regular public hearings, because they could have done it in what they call a reconciliation bill, in which case it would have just been an amendment to the budget. But there was a feeling that, why are we waiting till the last minute on this? It's not like we didn't know all along we wanted an increase in our allowance. But to suddenly introduce it in the last week of the session and put it out in the last days seemed a little, not quite above board.
So what was the governor's reasoning in vetoing this?
Well, I think there's a fairly universal belief that out-county lawmakers need more than $60 a day for the first 120 days they're here. I mean, you've got a situation where you've got to have a hotel or an apartment, and good luck finding an apartment for just 4 months or 5 months of the year. You've got living expenses. And what they would did is they suggested, let's use what the General Services Administration, the federal government, uses as a test of when you're in Phoenix during the winter. And that came out to about $190 a day. And that, I think everyone said, seemed fair. What really annoyed a lot of people, including some in-county lawmakers, is, wait, why are we then giving us half of that rate for driving from our own homes in Glendale or Scottsdale or Tempe to the Capitol? We get to go home every night. We don't have to eat all of our meals out or go ahead and buy food at the grocery store other than what we would be buying. And I think that was reflecting the governor's veto. He said, look, we've got a huge state. Out-county lawmakers certainly deserve something. I'm not sure that we need to be using taxpayer money to give in-county lawmakers a de facto raise just because voters won't give them a raise.
Howie, another area of veto. What about criminal justice reform? I thought coming in January, boy, we're going to see all sorts of reform there. It doesn't feel like the governor or a lot of lawmakers were on board with this. What happened there?
Well, this is one of those situations of your definition of reform, my definition of reform, the governor's definition of reform may all be different. It comes down to a question of how do you make charges? Under current law, if you commit a burglary on Monday and then on Tuesday and then on Wednesday, the prosecutors can take your Wednesday burglary and then allege the other two as prior actions and say, well, you're a habitual criminal. And so we're going to go for enhanced sentencing on you. The bill by Representative Ben Thoma, who's a Republican out of Peoria, not exactly wild-haired liberal, said, look, unless you actually have a conviction for the prior offenses.
Howie, it sounds like we're having a little bit of trouble with your connection. Are you still there? I think we've lost Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. We will try to get back to him soon if we can as the show continues.
Now we're going to check in with the editorial board of the Arizona Republic. It's a weekly segment where we talk about current issues facing the state and the nation, featured in columns on the newspaper's op-ed pages. President Trump's influence on politics hasn't been limited to U.S. elections and governing. The so-called populism he practices has also popped up in places like Brazil and the Philippines, and in the vote by U.K. voters to depart the European Union. In a column printed in The Republic over the weekend, John Gabriel argues this is not just a short-term issue. And with me for his weekly appearance to talk about that is the newspaper's editorial director, Phil Boas. Phil, what is at the core of John Gabriel's argument?
John is looking at elites in both parties and their notion that Trump may just be a one-off, that, you know, we have this weird moment in American history and that it'll go back to normal. And he is saying, look around the world. Take a look at Latin America, Eastern Europe, Western Europe, and Australia, and you will see political movements that are very much like what we've seen with Trumpism in America. You know, a whiff of populism and restrictive immigration policy and things like that, a lot of similarities.
How much is driven by fear, and why are we as humans so susceptible to the negative as opposed to thinking, well, things could get better?
I've believed, and with all due respect to John Gabriel, who I admire a lot, I think he's a great columnist, I think there is a strong craving for normalcy, and I think we'll eventually go back to it. I think there will be a time 25 years from now when we'll look back at the Trump era and think, did that really happen in America? And maybe I'm one of those elites or something, but I just don't think – I think the mold is broken on Donald Trump. I've never seen anybody like him in my lifetime, nobody who comes close who can get away with the kinds of things that he does. You know, Gabriel talks about not having to wince when you see a tweet from a president, you know, as you do with Donald Trump. But we've sort of grown used to it with Trump. We realize now it's all priced into who he is, that Trump doesn't do nice. Trump does jerk. That's who he is. He's a bad boy president, and we've gotten used to it. And guess what? Our allies have too. They used to light their hair on fire every time they read a tweet from him, and they don't anymore. They understand that this is sort of the man. He's an unusual guy.
If the person who succeeds Trump ends up sort of taking things from his playbook, maybe not quite as obnoxious, maybe not quite as tweet-centered, but someone like that who's at, you know, does one put us on a definitely a worse path? I mean, if we have what you're talking about, maybe this is just a blip, is that okay? And if it's not a blip, are we really in trouble as a country for a while?
Well, I think what Trump has done is that he has disrupted American politics. So one thing that John says, and I strongly agree with, is that politics aren't going to look the same. They're going to change. And I think Trump has created this space. He's burned out all the old growth with the way he has run his administration and done things. And it's going to create space for new coalitions, new ways of thinking on both the left and the right. And we're seeing that. Look at the ferment within the Democratic Party right now. All those candidates and all those ideas coming forward. I mean, so that's happening on the left, but it's also happening on the right, where people are rethinking what is conservatism.
Well, and that's from the political philosophy standpoint. What about civility? We'd be naive if we think that civility is always really civil. Sometimes people are just not being honest with each other. But is it better to have someone who is brash, like a President Trump, who at least, even though he seems to change his mind every 5 seconds based on what we see, at least he's out there just sort of saying whatever? Or is it better to have that polite conversation and maybe after you leave the meeting, you're saying, I'm not going to do a deal with that person, but at least we got along during the meeting?
So I think Trump is the expression of a lot of pent-up frustration on the right that finally came to the fore. It was frustration not just with Democrats and not just with Obama, but also with Republicans like John McCain and George W. Bush, who they felt were too conciliatory to the left. And so they wanted somebody who was going to throw punches for them, and they got somebody who was nasty and willing to do it. And they have a fighter for them, like a lot of the factions in America, these various special interest groups have fighters who are leading their movements, you know. So you have the white majority came up with their own, and they've got a fighter, a guy who throws punches. He's nasty, but he's going to stick to their issues and advance their causes, and that's what's happening.
Yeah. Okay, Phil, thanks.
Thanks.
Phil Boas is editorial director for the Arizona Republic.
And now let's turn to international news with our weekly check-in with our colleagues at the BBC. I'm joined this morning by Poona Gadusi, and we begin our conversation in Brazil, where on Thursday the country's Supreme Court is expected to vote to criminalize homophobia. Now, Brazil is an overwhelmingly Catholic country, and its new president has called himself, quote, a proud homophobe. So, Poona, what does all this mean?
Well, Lauren, the Brazilian Supreme Court has 11 judges. Six of them have already said they think the Brazilian Congress should have made attacks on gay and lesbian people a crime already. But since it hasn't, the court is expected to add homophobia to an existing list of prohibited forms of discrimination alongside things like race or gender.
Puna, what kinds of rights exist now for LGBT people there in Brazil?
Well, same-sex marriage was legalized there in 2013, and couples have been able to have the rights to adopt children as well, same-sex couples. But there seems to be a bit of a turn in public and state sentiment about this recently. My colleague Rafael Gomes from BBC Brazil has more on this.
For decades, Brazil has been known as a country where LGBT communities can enjoy a comfortable life and don't have to hide or deny their identity. But in more recent years, life has become a bit more difficult for many homosexuals and transgender people. A human rights group says that at least 141 LGBT people have been killed in Brazil just this year. And the country's president, Jair Bolsonaro, has made his opinions about the matter quite clear. Many times during his presidential campaign last year, Bolsonaro openly referred to homosexuals in a very derogatory way. In April, already as president, he voiced his concern about Brazil becoming a gay holiday destination. Also, last month, Bolsonaro suggested that he could choose an evangelical Christian to be placed on the country's Supreme Court, raising concerns among members of the LGBT community that the new justice could share the same views.
That was the BBC's Rafael Gomes.
And on Friday, there is expected to be a national women's strike in Switzerland. What are people going to be protesting there?
Yes, you may be surprised, Lauren, to hear, but Switzerland was one of the last countries in Europe to grant women the right to vote. That's in 1971 only. But the country's constitution has, for 30 years, guaranteed women equal pay with men. Although campaigners now are saying that they are no closer to actually executing this guarantee. One of Switzerland's labor unions found that women with the exact same qualifications and doing the exact same jobs as men actually earn 8% less. That's why they are taking to the streets.
So what kind of protests should we expect here?
Women are expected to stay out of work and not to do any housework either for the day. They're calling on protesters to wear violet clothing as a sign of solidarity with the other ones. Organizers have also said that if there are women who can't go on strike for the whole day, they should at least walk out at 3:24 in the afternoon. That's the time they say that women begin working for free compared to their male colleagues. And they're calling on the government to pass stricter laws to have oversight on how companies pay their employees, how equally they pay their employees. They say the current laws are too lax and don't apply tough enough to companies.
And on Sunday, India may be imposing, guess what, tariffs on goods from the U.S. So what's behind this latest trade war?
Yes, Lauren, there's no end to this so-called tariff wars. Mm. There's a few things behind this one. India was hit with tariffs on steel and aluminium last year, along with China and several other countries, as you know. India said they would respond to these by putting tariffs on American agricultural imports like almonds, walnuts and apples. Then another thing, the U.S. ended India's listing in something called the Generalized System of Preferences, or GSP. This is actually an agreement set up around 40 years ago, through which the U.S. offers better trading terms to poorer countries, though the Trump administration says that India has been abusing this system by not offering U.S. companies equal access to the Indian market.
So what can India do?
There isn't much really that India can do. The GSP system was a voluntary thing by the US, so India can't really protest being thrown out of a so-called preferential group. And although the Indian economy has been showing signs of slowing down a bit, the Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, has to make a really careful decision on this one, as our South Asia editor Ambarasan Etirajan explains.
There are two issues here. One, there were tariffs imposed by the US on select Indian products for steel and aluminium products. India hasn't really imposed any tariffs, even though they had announced a year ago that they will retaliate by imposing tariffs on US products. They kept on postponing it. And finally, they said they were waiting for the election results, and the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi was re-elected last month. And then there is a second issue of what they call as GSP. But India is in a very difficult situation here. On the one hand, the US is one of the largest trading partners. They do not want to upset that. On the other hand, they're also looking for strategic and military cooperation from the U.S. So India has to deal with this policy in a very delicate manner. So it will be highly unlikely that the government will announce that they are going to impose tariffs. At the same time, they are having behind-the-scenes talks with the U.S. leaders. They may be walking a very, very careful path here.
So, as the BBC's Ambarasaneti Rajan said there, a delicate choice indeed.
All right, that is Poona Ghadusi joining us from the BBC in London. Poona, thank you as always.
A pleasure.
At least when it comes to the Trump administration and related headlines, mention of the U.S.-Mexico border usually includes discussion of security and the construction of a new reinforced wall. But President Trump has also talked extensively of the need for better infrastructure around the country. An ambitious energy-related infrastructure project could lead to progress on that front, and some hope improve border security by strengthening the economy. If it all came together, the project would include wind turbines, desalination, and solar panels, among other things. ASU Mechanical and Aerospace Engineering Professor Ronald Adrian is part of the group of scientists and academics advocating the project, and he's with me to talk about that. Professor, we already know about desalination, but are there other ideas that come to mind for you with this overall project?
We plan to use renewable energy instead. So we'll be looking at solar and wind power. The solar power will be distributed along the border. The wind power will be concentrated at the coast where there is a nice supply of wind due to the ocean-land interaction. The problem, of course, with renewable energy is it only works when the wind blows and the sun shines. So we will probably have to construct a natural gas-fired plant. Natural gas is about the cleanest burning carbon fuel we have. And that plant will have to power our facilities like desalination and pumping during the nighttime.
Right.
And we have other ideas for load leveling. For example, it'd be possible when we get into the mountainous regions to, if there's a suitable location, have a reservoir that we could pump water into during the day and then flow it out at night. Okay. The main thing with the expensive facilities like desalination plants and the pipeline is to keep them working 24 hours a day. Mm-hmm. You've got so much sunk cost in them, you really need to make them produce.
Well, we know infrastructure development is obviously extremely expensive, but this is also something that would be an investment, potentially very logical investment for the future. Is that an obstacle, though, the fact that some of these projects sound so daunting, you need to have people who are willing to put a lot of money into it and also have some patience waiting for the project to sprout in some sense?
There's two kinds of payoffs in a project like this. And one is a short-term payoff of selling water, selling electricity. The other is a long-term payoff, which relates to the prosperity of the region going forward in time. Mm-hmm. And I draw the analogy between this project and, let's say, the series of dams and reservoirs constructed along our river systems, mm-hmm, to control that's to control the flow, but also to provide water to the areas it served. That sort of project, building Hoover Dam, for example, was a government project. Mm-hmm. Private industry couldn't see a profit by constructing Hoover Dam, but the whole region saw an enormous benefit over the years. And for that reason, it really is a government type of investment. Mm-hmm. We want to have private investment. We want to have these facilities constructed, owned, operated by private organizations and investors. At the same time, we'll need government involvement to fill in the long-term picture.
If something this ambitious were to come into play, how long could it take? How much money would it take?
a lot of the time will be spent acquiring land rights or rights of usage. And that's a complex issue. There's many different owners along the border. In fact, two-thirds of the border is privately held. And so, of course, the part that's in the hands of the government, that can go quickly. But it may not be the parts we need. So we're looking into that. And you can see, indeed, this is early days. And we need to do a great deal of study so as not to waste the public's money and investors' money. And so we've actually requested a large grant or contract from DHS and the government to study this problem, develop the plan, and also look at sociological issues. How do we do this so that we truly do improve the lives of people on both sides of the border?
Ronald Adrian is a professor of mechanical and aerospace engineering at ASU. You are listening to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 with Lauren Gilger. I'm Steve Goldstein. Still to come, the Phoenix Mercury are trying to get on a roll even without their best player. And a reminder that this summer, from 9 until 10, we're focusing on the stories of our state and region. The Takeaway will be airing from 10 to 11 as we follow this summer schedule.
Some people call it barbaric. Others say it's their right. Coyote killing contests, as they're sometimes called, are a hot topic of debate in our state right now. The contests reward hunters who can kill the most or the largest or sometimes the smallest animals in a set amount of time. Sometimes it's coyotes, other times bobcats, foxes, or mountain lions. The contests have raised ire from many in recent years, and many states and jurisdictions have passed bans on the practice or resolutions against them. Now the Arizona Game and Fish Commission has proposed a rule that would ban contests like these. But while opponents say this is indiscriminate killing that has to be stopped, some hunters worry this is just the toe in the door and marks the beginning of a full-on assault on their hunting rights. We'll hear more from the commissioner who proposed this rule, as well as one of the organizers of one of these events in a few minutes. But we begin with Matt Francis, one of the people who has worked to stop contests like these. He's a Prescott cosmologist who works with the national group Project Coyote to stop these contests. And he says his work in cosmology was at the center of his life until he got an email one day last fall about these animal killing contests.
I thought they were exaggerating. And as a scientist, I figured, well, I'm going to find out. I'm going to look into this. And I did. And I spent a few hours actually on the internet. I even called a kill contest organizer in Wyoming and spoke to him. I spoke via social media to people who participate, and also I went on different websites, Project Coyote being one of them, where there's a plethora of information. And what I found is that the email was actually being quite conservative, really, to the horror of what's actually happening with our wildlife.
What's the scale of this, especially here in Arizona? There are, how often is this happening?
We know of at least 20 that happen every year in Arizona, and we have reason to believe there's several more than we know of. This is just what we've been able to find out through social media. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they'll use the excuse of predator contests are a way to manage populations of coyotes, which Arizona Game and Fish does that themselves. But the contests are held year-round. They're not just during fawning season in March and April. They're held year-round. So they're really not a management tool anyway. Indiscriminate killing isn't really a population tool. It causes, when you kill alpha members of a coyote pack, that causes dysfunction in the pack. And coyotes are smart. Alpha members suppress the breeding of the other members of the pack. Well, if you shoot one of them, the other members are now free to breed, and they will. They'll try to reestablish their previous population, while at the same time other coyotes from surrounding areas will also come in to fill the vacancy left from a contest.
So you're saying this would actually be creating more coyotes, not less?
It does create more coyotes, yes.
And it's totally legal, though, most places, right?
Right now it is legal, yeah. California and Vermont have both passed bans against this. New Mexico passed a ban this year. Oregon, New York, and New Jersey are both looking to pass legislation, we hope, this year. Mm-hmm. And Arizona Game and Fish we hope will pass their rule very soon.
You've also gone to various jurisdictions, counties, cities, towns, et cetera, to try to pass resolutions, I understand, around the state. And that's pretty extensive at this point. What does that look like?
Yeah, that's how we started. So we started going to the Yavapai County supervisors meetings and rationalizing that the county encompassing many cities and towns would be the right place to start. And I was looking for an ordinance to pass that would have, you know, the force of law behind it. But I quickly found out, because of the attorneys that would have to be involved and the fines and fees, it would be impossible to do this. So first we approached Yavapai County, and then there was a contest called Santa Slay, S-L-A-Y, that was set to take place in Dewey-Humboldt, and that was in the near future. So we went to that town council, and we found, well, it was easy to find like-minded people. Most people think this is abhorrently disgusting when they learn what's going on. So Dewey-Humboldt passed a resolution. Then I think it was Yavapai County followed suit, then Flagstaff, and then Coconino County. And at that time, we had approached the state government. We found people that were disgusted by this, and that's what's really pushing this.
Mm-hmm. And this isn't like everybody who likes to hunt would be for this, right? Like, there are lots of people who are hunters and who are, you know, enthusiasts about that kind of sport, but who would not support this, it sounds like.
Every single people we know that you and I would consider as an ethical hunter is against this. Mm-hmm. They know that killing contests are horrible for the reputation of ethical hunting. It's a black eye. And we've even seen on social media forums other hunters and hunting groups speaking out against this. So no, normal hunters see that this is a threat to their right to hunt. It's really bad in public eye what's happening.
So as you've kind of carried out this ongoing campaign, this has got to be a lot of work. Why do you do it?
How can I not? You know, it's like I study cosmology, and that's really my passion. And my family and my dog and all the hobbies and things I like to do outdoors, these are all my passions. But when I learned what's happening with our wildlife and the things that I love, I just feel like there's no way I cannot act.
Matt Francis with Project Coyote. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Lauren.
Nicole Shores is with the group Call in the Country, and she and her husband organize some of these killing contests. She says she's not against regulation of them, but she doesn't agree with the rule as it's written.
We can all agree, I believe, that these tournaments should be regulated. So instead of doing an all-out ban, it would make more sense for the Arizona Game and Fish Department to just start regulating the tournaments.
For her, the proposed ban feels like an assault on our country's hunting heritage.
We're feeling like this is just the first step, and that ultimately, like, the goal is the demise of hunting as we all know it.
So why is Game and Fish proposing this rule? I sat down with the man who proposed it to find out. Kurt Davis is a longtime Game and Fish commissioner and a hunter himself, and he says he understands both sides of this debate, but to him, it's about ethics.
Well, there's been some of the talk about this nationally, and there's the Bible of wildlife conservation is called the North American Model for Wildlife Conservation. And as a commissioner, you really use that as a tool in making policy related to the sports of hunting and angling. Mm-hmm. And it explicitly talks about in the North American Model a very important tenet, which is you don't profit off of wildlife. You don't profit off of hunting of wildlife. And these contests bleed into that area because you pay an entry fee, there can be prizes or cash associated with it. And so from my perspective, it bled into violating that tenet of the North American Model. And that's why I proposed putting a rule in place to ban these kinds of contests.
So essentially you're saying, you know, there's nothing wrong with hunting here. It's the cash prize part of this that makes it a little bit difficult in your book.
Yes, and part of your role as a commissioner and when you're contemplating the rules that govern how we hunt and fish in Arizona, you are supposed to contemplate and consider social aspects, mm-hmm. as they're called. And a lot of people who are not hunters don't necessarily understand that kind of event, and it's understandable that they don't. So the social contemplation is part of the analysis that you do as a commissioner.
That these towns and cities and counties are saying, we condemn this, this is horrible.
Yeah, and people, you know, some people, again, I want to caveat, it's very important to note, you need to have predator management in Arizona. We're a state that is blessed with over 800 species of wildlife, and the Game and Fish Department has to manage all 828 species. To manage them effectively, you have to manage predators, because if you don't manage predators, you can end up harming certain species who will get overhunted by predators. Mm-hmm. So managing coyotes, bobcats, mountain lions, those kinds of things is an important part of what the department and the commission does. And hunters are a very important tool in that management so that we can preserve and conserve all 828 species. These contests, though, get kind of outside the realm of that. And so that's why the commission's proposed the rule.
Sure, sure. I want to talk a little bit about what it is that Game and Fish already does on its own to control the populations of predators like coyotes. There are plenty of programs that you carry out, right?
Yes, and there's lawful hunting of coyotes. And there are a lot of people that hunt coyote, you know, all forms of predators. And any Arizonan who buys a hunting license can go out and hunt predators like coyotes, mountain lions, bobcats, and they help the state manage that wildlife. And I'll give you a very specific example. During the birthing season for antelope, both pronghorn, Sonoran pronghorn, and antelope that you find up in northern Arizona, birthing season, there can be a catastrophic event where coyotes in particular will feed on ungulates being born. And so you have to manage those predators. When we translocate bighorn sheep, like we recently did down in outside of Tucson in Oro Valley, mm-hmm. you have to manage the mountain lions in that area so that the sheep have a chance to learn their habitat and successfully reproduce in that environment. So hunters are an important part of the tool. There are a large number of Arizona hunters that do hunt predators. Contests are, again, a little bit of a different perspective on this, which is you're giving away cash and prizes for killing the most coyotes or bobcats or whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. And that's where the commission is drawing a line with the proposal of this rule.
So you say you can understand, you know, the social kind of outrage that these have raised in recent months here, in recent years. They'll call it, you know, cruel, indiscriminate killing against the ethical hunting model that you're mentioning here. But we also reached out to a group who puts on these contests, and they say that this is, you know, a foothold. This is the first step in the door of over-regulating and eventually just getting rid of hunting altogether. So when you're considering a rule like this, what does the Game and Fish Commission consider?
So it considers, and required by law to consider, the social impact, the economic impact, and obviously the scientific impact. So in consideration of the rule, you look at all three of those things. And I understand why some of the groups that are involved in this kind of activity believe in the toehold issue. We have to be very careful in our country and in this state, especially as our state urbanizes mm-hmm. to the degree it has. A lot of people don't realize we have the most urbanized state in the country other than Rhode Island. We're more urbanized than New York, Connecticut, New Jersey. With that comes many people who don't understand how wildlife is managed, how the management is funded, and the importance of hunting in the management of wildlife. So I understand that argument, but again, I go back to the North American model, the definition, the tenet that we do not use wildlife for economic gain.
All right. Kurt Davis with the Arizona Game and Fish Commission. Thank you so much.
You bet.
And the Arizona Game and Fish Commission is set to make their decision about the rule banning these killing contests this month.
The Phoenix Mercury had a very successful 2018 season, making the WNBA Finals before losing to the eventual champion Seattle Storm. But the weeks leading up to this season were full of nervousness, at least for Mercury fans. That's because guard Diana Taurasi, one of the greatest players in WNBA history, injured her back and had to have a procedure that has forced her to miss the beginning of the season. With me to talk about the Mercury and their expectations for 2019 is Alexis Manzanares, who covers the team for The Athletic. Alexis, how has this absence of Taurasi affected the Mercury in training camp and this very early part of the season?
You know, it's not really affecting it too much because she's there. She's at, you know, every practice. She's on the sidelines, you know, chomping her gum and running out there during timeouts. So her presence is felt just in general on the court. However, though, you know, they are missing a huge piece to their puzzle.
Yeah, she's one of the greatest players of all time, obviously. So has that, did Coach Brondello have to make changes? And how long is Taurasi supposed to be out?
She's due back mid-season. You can tell she's anxious to get back. But as far as the team without her, Sandy Brondello has been talking about their identity without Diana. And right now, you know, that first game in Seattle was tough and I think a good wake-up call. But their game here against the Aces was fantastic. And they looked good and their offense was running well without Diana, and all signs are pointing to them being pretty successful as they wait for her return.
So what are the strengths of the team then without her there?
Without her, I think the strengths, they really rely on their depth a little more. You know, Diana takes up so much, not room, but just talk. You know, of course, she's one of the best players ever. And so now they can focus on, you know, third-year player Yvonne Turner, who had her first career double-double. So that was huge.
Big, okay, yeah.
Essence Carson, who's, you know, a veteran in the league, but her first season with the Mercury led the team in scoring on Friday. So that was big. And players are just able to kind of work a little better in the system and get their own footing while they wait for Diana, which will help them in the end.
Is there a feeling that at some point in the next season or two, you have to get ready for what is next for the organization? Because even if Taurasi wouldn't admit it, I mean, even LeBron James is not as good as he was. The same thing will happen to her.
I don't know. I don't see, there's something special in these players. I don't see her declining, you know, anytime soon, and I don't know how. I want the water that she's drinking because, you know, her and Sue Bird and these veterans, even Sancho Little, who's been in the league 14 years as well, they're still playing at such a high level. One day they'll probably get ready for that, but now I don't think they're even looking at that. But even, like I said, you know, the depth of this team and the three rookies that they brought on, I think they'd be in good position eventually without Diana.
So are expectations really high for this season, even without her for a while? Is there a concern that, you know, you're going to have to just sort of tread water? Or do you think, based on what you said, that the team expects to be in good sort of playoff shape when she comes back?
I think they expect to be in pretty decent shape. You know, it's a short season, so you can't afford to have a big lull without any of your players. So I think the expectations still, they seem to remain the same. You know, it's still a favorite to make it to the championship and hopefully win, since they got so close to being there last year. But I think, you know, it's such a big storyline without Diana that I don't know if they're almost getting sick of it. But, you know, they're playing the same with or without her.
That is Alexis Manzanares, who covers the Phoenix Mercury for The Athletic. The Mercury's record so far is 2-2. Their next home game is Friday against the LA Sparks. That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.